Now, I guess after the conference and a week of imaging of very complex objects. Now, this week begins with basic things, atoms, you know, they are round things, right? And what I'm going to discuss is partly planned and partly was motivated by things that were said and mentioned and discussed in the conference as well as last week. For example, I didn't expect to hear in this conference the Hamburg-Brown and Twist experiment. Nevertheless, John Miao was talked about coherence a lot, and we had long discussions over lunch about that. So things like perturbation theory, short pulses. So I would like to present a set of topics before I go into discussing some results, if you want, of recent experiments and what we can expect from the next few years. Now, this is just to, before I forget, there are what I, this is not a talk of our, about our research results, which nevertheless will be mentioned in part, but these are people that were involved in what I'm going to mention. Now, 50 years ago, well, 60 years ago, the laser was new, and it was intense for those days in the optical range, and coherent, a word that John Miao used a lot and liked it a lot, and we had a lot of discussion about that. And then for a long time, the laser was called the solution in search of a problem. People didn't know how to do with it. It was a weak helium neon laser. Eventually, in the decade of the 70s, lasers became tunable. I don't know if anybody, anyone in this room knows what a flash lamp pumped dye laser was. But anyway, that was the workhorse of tunable lasers, modest intensities. 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 watts per square centimeter. And a lot of nonlinear spectroscopy was done with those. It was, well, a few photon processes, multiphoton processes, nonlinear optics, resonantly enhanced multiphoton processes, which became a standard tool in molecular physics and still is. Now we have a new wavelength range. And what I would like to discuss is what, from what we have learned over the last 50 years, can carry over, and what not. The first thing I want to start with is, well, the words that have been mentioned: rate equations, single photon, multiphoton processes, field fluctuations, multiple ionization, and so on. All of this will come into the discussion. Now, I want to start with Ludimoro's, a statement that Ludimoro made. And by the way, I'm not talking behind his back. I discussed this with him. And then he's coming back. And about perturbation theory, this is a word very much used and abused a lot. So now he made the statement that perturbation theory is valid for a bound-bound transition as long as the Rabi frequency is smaller than the separation of the energy levels. Well, depending on what you mean by perturbation theory has broken down long before that. And let me start then from some simple things. Let's start with that particular thing. So now, let's take two levels and a radiation omega, the standard spectroscopy for over the 20th century. We excite, so this is level G, this is level E, and we excite this level with intensity such that the coupling due to the field, which is the Rabi frequency, which is proportional to the electric field times a dipole moment, Eg. As long as this is much smaller than this gamma, then you excite and the thing decays, then you are definitely within perturbation theory, no question about that, that's the standard. So then you can, we can describe this by a rate with which this is excited up there. The source can be monochromatic, may not be monochromatic. If it's not monochromatic, then there is bandwidth that you have to put in there. And you can write, for example, a little equation which has the rate with which the amplitude of the ground state leaves the ground state is 1/2 gamma E. This is this gamma E. Delta square plus 1/4 gamma E square. Monochromatic source. If the source has a bandwidth, we have to put that in there. Now, okay, this is certainly perturbation theory, and this can be excited even, this is the detuning from that state, can be in principle excited even if it's detuned, much less if it's far detuned, etc. Now, as soon as this Rabi frequency is the frequency at which the system goes up and down because of the electric field. As soon as this, this is now, let's say the two-level atom, let's say the ground state and the first excited state, what people do in laser cooling, okay? Alkali atom S to P transition. But there are other states here. Somewhere up there is, of course, the ionization potential, not on scale. There are other states here. With this, so this is perturbation theory, what I described. Now, as soon as the Rabi frequency becomes comparable to the separation of these levels, then this two-level approximation doesn't work anymore. But even before that, when this Rabi frequency becomes comparable or larger than gamma, then you don't have perturbation theory. You have a two-level system, and you have to solve the problem within a 2x2 density matrix equation, and you have to do the rotating wave approximation. If you don't do the rotating wave approximation, the problem is not solvable exactly. But and as a matter of fact, this two-level system, if you don't do the rotating wave approximation, if you do a numerical solution of that, it will give you high-order harmonics. If you take the dipole moment, right? That's the most elementary. So it's driven strongly, it's driven non-linearly. So that's the word now, non-linearity. That as soon as this becomes larger, so what does this mean? This means that the system goes up and down many times before it can decay. So then you don't have a single transition up. You have to talk about the populations of it. Now, if, as I said, now this becomes larger than the separation of this level from those levels, then you have to enlarge the basis. Perturbation theory, as I described it, has broken down. Instead of two levels, to put three levels, four levels, five levels, as many as this radiation will excite substantially. Now, Lou de Moro said that perturbation theory has broken down when the Rabi frequency, this Rabi frequency, becomes equal to this energy separation. You probably didn't notice it, but I noticed it. He said that, right? He said that people say, to be exact, okay? Well, you see now, if the Rabi frequency becomes equal to that, it is already equal to something like that. So definitely, now, there is an issue. Now, if this is larger than EG, but smaller than the ionization potential, then you have to put a lot of levels there. But if it becomes equal to the ionization potential or bigger, then you have to solve the system exactly, quote unquote. You have to solve the time-dependent Schrödinger equation that we all know, that is used to treat problems in strong fields as we know them in the long wavelength regime, where one sets up a time-dependent Schrödinger. But there, of course, there, and now I want to bring this up, in the long wavelength regime, it is the outer electron that participates. So the field pulls out one electron, which is set into oscillation. We heard about this before, which then can produce a high order harmonic, can produce above threshold ionization, and if the ponderomotive energy, which I will bring up in a minute, is enough to knock out another electron, then it can knock out another electron, but it's all done via the oscillation of a valence electron. A long wavelength, which, well, long wavelength we mean infrared, really, that's where the strong laser are, does not see the inner electrons. Now, so that's why the so-called single active electron approximation is a good model for treating high-order harmonic generation and above-threshold ionization. What is above-threshold ionization? Well, above-threshold ionization is, like most of people, I know I'm going to bore a number of people in this room, but I hope I have a few new things for everybody. Now, this is the continuum. Above threshold ionization is the absorption of photons above the continuum, which gives photoelectron peaks beyond the lowest order. And now, this will happen when the pulse is short. And we have to specify what we mean by short pulse. I'll say for a moment, when the pulse is short in terms of cycles, the actual duration doesn't really matter. So if one femtosecond or two femtoseconds infrared pulse is short, but one femtosecond X-ray pulse is not short in this sense. It has many, many, many cycles. And the above threshold ionization, high order harmonic generation, were observed only when the pulses became short. The sub-picosecond and, yes?
But it cannot be independent of the pulse energy. I mean, if I read.
Pardon?
It cannot be independent of the pulse energy. If you keep the pulse energy fixed and you make it shorter and shorter, I see that, but if you make the pulse energy smaller and smaller as you decrease the pulse duration, then I don't think this is true. Mm-hmm. You can always, so to speak, stay, especially at high frequency, you can basically ensure that you go with one photon straight, say, to the continuum, and that your pulse energy is so low that you're guaranteed to be in first order perturbation theory, then a short pulse will not necessarily give you ATI, no matter how short it is, actually.
Well, okay, now, fine.
There is a second kind of perturbation parameter, which is intensity, right? So you have multi-photon, some people also call multi-photon processes perturbative, hence order, if the intensity is small. I think this is...
Okay, let's discuss this.
Peter, the pulse doesn't need to be short to observe ATI. You can have long pulses and short.
Okay, let me... Now, ATI is always there, no matter what the pulse is, no matter what the intensity is. There are other diagrams, except that they are unobservable, right? They are just orders of magnitude down. The issue, therefore, when I say you need a short pulse is whether, in under realistic conditions, you will see any signal there. Okay, now, what do I mean by long and short now? Why do I say that? And see whether we agree. Here is the pulse. And let's say that, and this is important now because it pertains to the FEL. And let's say that the peak power, peak intensity is such that it will give you substantial ATI. It means that, substantial ATI, ATI under, under perturbation theory, this peak is totally unobservable, this and they go down by orders of magnitude. Now, if you increase the intensity, eventually these peaks become equal. In fact, the ionization potential moves up, and this peak disappears, and it's called channel closing, and so on. Now, even if the peak value is such that it would give you many, many observable ATI peaks, the atom will never get a chance to see that because it will ionize through multiphoton processes down here. It will be gone. That's what I mean. And that was the problem. That's why ATI and high order harmonic generation was really observed substantially when the pulses became short. Okay? So it's in that sense that I mean. Now, Robin seems to nod in agreement.
I'm nodding.
Jan Michael seems to be unhappy.
I was wondering if you could say a few words how you would put into perspective multiphoton as perturbation theory. If the intensity is small, right? When does the order of photons as perturbative process? And that's another way to look at.
I'm not sure I understand what you want me to do. What you say now? I mean, if I need three photons to bridge the ionization potential.
Yeah, I think this is, in a way, what Robin meant. If the intensity is very low, it simply does not occur, right? And you are,
what?
If your ponderomotive potential, in a way, is small compared to the binding energy, then you can do single photon, and it doesn't really matter.
I would never do single photon here. The photon energy is not enough to ionize. Ionization, I picked an arbitrary example where you need three photons to bridge ionization potential. There, it's only three photons that will produce ionization. It's always there, but unobservable if the intensity is low. Okay?
That's a funny way to put it.
No. Why do you say it's a funny way to put it? I mean, it was always there in the 20th century, but it's only when lasers came up. Has substantial intensity that you could see some. And this was done with a flash lamp pump dye lasers at intensities 10 to the 7 watts per square centimeter. Mm-hmm. Okay? For sodium atoms and things like that. Okay? And three photon, for example, three photon ionization, I say three photon ionization when three photons is the minimum number needed to ionize. All right? Otherwise, okay? So you need, whether you need, what intensity you need to see that, what does it mean to see that? To observe it in an experiment, all right? I mean, it depends on the atom. Right? If you take, for example, take the hydrogen atom. Yeah, I want to bring this up. The hydrogen atom and the neon atom, I'm sorry, and the xenon atom, they have the same ionization potential, practically. Okay?
But I find it strange to say it's always there because this kind of does not reflect perturbation theory, right? Perturbation theory acknowledges the fact that something is always there, but you don't see it. This is why you do perturbation theory, right?
I don't understand what you're saying.
You make the full solution, so everything is always there, but the fact is you don't see it, and this is why you go to first or second order perturbation theory in some parameter to acknowledge the fact it's there, but you don't see it. So for me, this is the purpose of perturbation theory, to do that. Therefore, I don't understand you say you make perturbation theory, but on the other hand, you say it's always there. I'm saying
single photon ionization in this scenario is impossible. Energy conservation.
Yeah.
Okay?
Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The lowest order for ionization is three-photon ionization, which in perturbation theory is a generalized cross-section. I'll come to that, you know that, to the third power of the intensity. All right? That's what I'm saying. We agree with that?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Now, the pulse, that's why you need a pulse to be short, because it will drain the initial state population during the rise. Yes.
A long pulse is a pulse that will ionize the atom before the maximum.
If the maximum,
for a long pulse.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Okay. If the maximum is, that will give you substantial, all right?
That's your definition.
These are all matters of degree, ladies and gentlemen, okay?
The first ATI experiment were done with 2 picosecond pulse of YAG laser, so it's rather long compared. You have some...
You're referring to the first Agostini experiment?
The first Agostini experiment was 2 picosecond.
How many peaks did he see of ATI? Yeah, two or three?
Yeah,
okay, that's what I'm saying, okay, yeah, sure. But then now, he did. By the way, do you, now, we're not going to get far today, but that's okay, that's why we're here. Do you know how high-order harmonic generation was discovered? The French must know it. I happen to know it because what happened is that in the mid-80s, someone made the claim, and I will come to that later, that pumping the xenon atom with 6 EV photons at, with picosecond pulse and intensities 10 to the 14, he was exciting the whole outer shell. He was setting it to an oscillation. Well, I don't have to specify it, but anyway, that's right. Charlie Rhodes, right. That he was setting up the whole outer shell into oscillation, which would produce X-rays. And that, on that he would build a laser, and this person got a lot of money to put such a laser on a satellite to knock down Russian... whatever. Okay. Now, of course, there was commotion in the community. It turned out that was not the case. The Saclay people, tried to look for the X-rays because what Charlie Rhodes looked so multiple ionization, and you heard about multiple ionization in the conference. Those of you that were here, right? And that's the other. Now, the Saclay people said, okay, let's look for the X-rays if this is true. They put the gas there, they pump it, no radiation is coming out. They increase the pressure, they put more gas in there. And lo and behold, eventually radiation is coming out. But it's not X-rays, it's the harmonics of the source they were pumping it with. And that's how it started. Right? They saw it with a long pulse, okay, but not many harmonics. Okay, let's not quarrel about
it. Certainly not non-perturbative.
Yeah,
pardon?
Let's not quarrel about that. But nevertheless, with that pulse, long pulse, they would never see this, you know, high order harmonics. Those high order harmonics and an extended ATI were observed when the pulses became short.
Yes.
Because we agree with them, that's all I'm saying, huh? All right? Okay, now. When this Rabi frequency becomes Cobbler ionization potential, you are in a strong field, you have to solve the time dependent Schrödinger equation, and for long wavelength you can do that. You can, because it's a single active electron approximation. Right? You have one electron which is just, you have a potential. Now, it is true that refinements of these theories require that you put in some information about what the electron sees when it comes back, so some excitation of the core and so on, but nevertheless, a second electron is never ejected by the field itself. it is ejected by the returning electron through a collision. And three electrons is a rarity, and it's not, okay? So that is an important difference for the long wavelength, while in the short wavelength, the situation is different. You can eject more than one electron by the radiation of the cell directly. Yes, Robin?
So if one is substantially above the knee,
pardon?
If one is substantially above the knee in the double ionization yield, then I would say you can argue that, so to speak, the second electron was ejected by the field.
Well, you're saying that the sequential process then comes in.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
At some point it always
does. But it's a sequential process. All right. Yeah.
It's one by one.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Now, all right, we're moving farther. Let's now move farther. Okay, let's discuss this. So now we have an ionization potential here. And then through some order process, we will need this. We come here, and then one electron has been ejected, and then through some other process, another electron can be ejected. This is called sequential, which means that one electron is ejected, the ion goes mostly to the ground state, and then a few other photons, depending on the order of the process, eject the other electron. And this can go on forever. And that's, in fact, what was happening forever, until the intensity, depending on intensity. And that's, as a matter of fact, what was happening in Charlie Rhodes' experiment. It was sequential and not this direct. And this is an issue I hope we'll get in today, right?
But sequential can nevertheless be non-perturbative.
Pardon?
Sequential can nevertheless be non-perturbative.
Can have?
Can be non-perturbative.
Sequential can be non-perturbative. Yes, of course. But if sequential, if sequential is non-perturbative, then already you are in the non-perturbative regime, I would say. So you could not talk about, say, M photon perturbation theory for this step and M photon perturbation theory for that step.
Well, but in a very strict sense, once you're blowing away the ground state, if you're saturating one photon ionization process, and strictly speaking, not in the, you know, you can, if you have a one photon ionization cross section, go straight into the continuum, and you have an intensity that's high enough so that the ionization probability is high, or in other words, that the ground state depletion is high, that does not mean that it was entirely wrong to use the one photon cross section, but it was wrong to assume that you're strictly speaking in a true perturbative limit.
Well, I'm not sure let me see whether we, here is one photon ionization, perturbation theory, cross section.
But Robin says is you cannot treat the ground state as a reservoir in that case.
Right. As what?
As a reservoir. Right. It's actually modified.
Exponential decay. Exponential decay. If I have perturbation theory, if I am in this regime, okay, if I'm in this regime, I have a transition probability per unit time that takes me out of this there. And if I wait long enough, no matter how weak the field is, the ground state will disappear. Perturbation theory has not broken down, it's exponential decay.
No, perturbation theory, strictly speaking, is only valid when the ground state is essentially undepleted.
Yeah.
No, I guess I
would.
Why? I mean, suppose we have
definition of perturbation theory.
Well, I mean, if you want to define it that way, but you see, what I say is that perturbation theory, what I call perturbation theory here, is a situation in which the field is weak enough for a cross section to be meaningful, and long enough for a cross section to be meaningful. And as long as this is valid, then if I wait long enough, I have exponential decay. the ground state will disappear with E to the minus the cross section times the intensity T.
You can't write that down in first order perturbation theory from the ground state.
No. I have a rate. I have a rate equation. I have a rate equation, right? And the perturbation theory comes in that I was able to define this quantity. Which this quantity in single photon, let me write it down now, because it's a final state, an operator times the ground state. As long as I can write that. Now, Robin, if I take an extremely weak source, right, and I have, and I wait long enough, the atom will disappear.
No, what I mean, if you do time dependent perturbation theory and you're starting from the ground state,
yeah,
you won't get that exponential decay, say, in leading order perturbation theory.
If I do the time dependent perturbation theory, the time dependent.
You're already mixing things, right? No? In a sense, you're mixing the notion of having calculated a cross section.
Yeah.
Then you're going, say, through the Schrödinger equation and you're basically deriving a rate equation. When deriving the rate equation, one does not use perturbation theory. All one does is one introduces some kind of memory loss effect, right, to integrate the equation for the coherence so that you can get equations of motion just for the populations.
Sure.
No perturbation theory was applied, right? Then you have your rate equations.
Yep.
And it turns out that the entries in the rate equations happen to equal those cross sections.
Yeah.
But nowhere has any assumption about perturbation theory been made when deriving the rate equations. So doing perturbation theory from the ground state is one thing. Deriving the rate equations where these coefficients happen to appear is a second thing. And then when one solves the rate equations, yes, you can at some intensity you get complete depopulation of the ground state. But it's not the same thing as saying you did rigorous perturbation theory from the ground state.
Well, I don't know what you mean, because here this we're talking about ionization. I have a ground state, nothing, a bound state and a continuum. I eliminate the continuum through the pole approximation because I assume that the field is weak enough not to have much else, even if I have a guy. I cannot have anything else. I cannot have radio oscillation from a continuum down, which is different from this situation, where I have two states and I can go up and down. So I eliminate, and in all of these things, in eliminating the continuum from my equations, that's not no rate equation yet. I have the density matrix. I have the Schrödinger equation, if you want. In eliminating the continuum, and I do the Markov approximation because the continuum is smooth. If the continuum is not smooth, and I have here an autonizing state, then I cannot do that. I have to put in the autonizing statement. So for a smooth continuum, all of this is, if you wish, what I call, then I get a cross section, and indeed I get the rate equation, because that's what I started saying. If I have a weak enough field, which is such that it goes up slower than it can come back down in the bound transition, so I'm not sure where. It may be a bit semantic now, this issue.
I think we just sit in the sequential process,
yeah,
especially in FEL fields, where you, yeah, can put several electrons out with one photon each. You said this is beyond perturbation theory.
I said,
yeah,
that?
Yeah, you said that.
I didn't say anything on that yet. No,
that.
No, I didn't. No, I have not made a statement about that yet. No. No.
Okay.
No.
What did you say about that?
Well, I simply...
Careful, we have it on tape.
Yeah. Well, to the best of my recollection, I mentioned the FEL, and I said the issue of sequential, etc., will come up. That's what I said. I didn't say much.
Huh?
All right. Okay.
Now, let's move on.
Who? Now, okay, there was something, I mean, Alfred McKay mentioned the Molo triplet. I'm not going to come into that now because it's not really relevant. I mean, it would be, but I want to respect the time. Now, the issue here, of course, that we have a few photon ionization or multi-photon ionization you have non-linear processes. Okay, you have non-linear processes. That's even in perturbation theory. So then we discussed what happens when this rabbit frequency becomes. Now, if you have, of course, here, all right, here is another issue. Suppose you have you pump a bound state, and then you need two more photons to go out. You can still be within perturbation theory, but now you have two states that are on resonance array, strongly quote-unquote coupled. This means that there are the oscillations between those two states. Now, then, depending if the intensity is not too large, you have two photon ionization from that state. Okay, now you have to set up a set of density matrix equations, which means that you have to treat these two states exactly, quote-unquote, a two-level system with a density matrix. You have to eliminate the continuum as long as the intensity is not too large, and then you will get a set of density matrix equations. This is the resonantly enhanced multiphotonization that has become a standard tool, and you can now you have many variants of that: two-photon resonant, three-photon ionization, three-photon resonant, four-photon ionization, etc., etc. The only thing is that the Rabi frequency now becomes higher order and so on, right? Now, however, let me point out something that if you now have this innocent problem of two levels, what people do in laser cooling practically? Within the rotating wave approximation and so on, and the Rabi frequency now here becomes much larger than gamma, you have a nonlinear problem. You have a nonlinear problem in the sense that the populations eventually equalize, of course, but you have spontaneous emission, which don't quite equalize. And then things are not just simply linear with intensity, right? And here is where the first example of where the field fluctuations become important, and that. Okay, now, multiphoton business now. As I said, this is now single photon. In single photon ionization, what you need of anything, what you need is a ground state, initial state, whatever, and the final state. And if you are going to knock out one electron, you have to calculate this matrix element within perturbation theory. Okay? To calculate the matrix element. The more complicated the system is, the more difficult this is, and especially this one now. If you are in a complicated molecule, the continuum state is but basically you have to calculate one. The radiation is the initial state and the final state. Now, if you have the simplest extension of that, a two photon, now it is, let me write, let's see what is the next transparency. Write down a simple example. And as I said, I know I'm boring many of you, but sorry, we have to. Now, single photon. Now, for the two photon, now we have here, again, one electron. It is that we are moving out, okay? It is this operator. And you have a sum over all states of the system. And those who give zero will give zero, the rest will be. So it is now this, it's this that you have to calculate. And now the initial and the final state are not enough. You need now, certainly the initial state, certainly the final state, but you need to do this summation. And in principle, depending on the system. In hydrogen, you can do that exactly with, through the Green's function. If you know the Green's function, and you can do that exactly for any system. And there are of course generalizations of the Green's function through quantum defect theory, where you can do that for practically any single electron atom within quantum defect theory. The Russians back in the early 70s did a lot of that. You want to say something? Okay, now, free photon, etc. Now, all right. Here is the generalized, this is called now generalized cross-section. In this case, the rate, what shall I call it? dW, dt, the rate with which the system departs the ground state, is the cross-section, which is centimeter square, times the flux, or the intensity. Now, in this case, this two-photon cross-section, generalized cross-section, sometimes we put a hat on it, sometimes not, we also call it cross-section, times the square of the flux. Within perturbation theory. This is, we're still in perturbation theory. And now, if you have many photons to bridge the gap, here is the whole expression. You have to do, for n photons, you have n terms here, summation of n minus 1 over n minus 1 intermediate states. And the point here is that in any multiphoton process within perturbation theory, it is the whole atom that participates, not the initial and final state, and you have to know it. Now, if you have a two-electron atom, and I'll come to that shortly, then these are states of the, if you want to treat the two-electron system, of the two-electron system. You know, if one electron, say, if you have a single valence atom, but single valence electron, you can get away with the core and okay. Now, I have put this here because I have heard, and I heard it in this conference, or at least in discussion, can you calculate 19 photon ionization cross-section? The answer is yes and no. In hydrogen, you can. Right? In hydrogen, you can. And in fact, you can in any system, but depends on what accuracy you want, okay? All you need is the basis. The basis, all right, now, here is a six-photon ionization cross-section of hydrogen calculated by Edna Karule in Latvia in 1970 or 69 or something like that. What computer she had, I have no idea. Maybe it was a manual computer, right? But she... She calculated up to 16 photon ionization.
Yeah.
Right? As I said. In fact, she was kind enough many years ago to send me a report in Russian, which I still have, and I look at the figures. That's where this figure is from. Right? So, now, of course, what are those peaks? Those peaks are every time the photon energy becomes equal to this energy, to the energy difference between the initial state and some intermediate state, the denominator becomes zero, so you get a peak. Of course, there is no divergence. That denominator does not become zero, because if nothing else, an excited state has a finite lifetime. So strictly
speaking. Did she calculate the power broadening and the level shift?
No. She simply calculated these expressions using a Green's function, and also she used a Sturmian basis up to 16th order. Okay? Now, in those days, power broadening and so on was not. But what I want to say is that power broadening would be relevant if now you have a photon. This is six photonization overall. I don't know what this is, or how many photons it is, but doesn't matter, okay? If you are here, if you are on resonance with that state, then the issue of power broadening comes in, okay? You also mentioned shifts. Yes, indeed, everything shifts. I mean, all states, if the field is sufficiently large, will shift. Now, whether this is important or not depends on the intensity, okay? Now, so then this can, now I want to draw your attention to this, to the structure. Oh yeah, I'm sure you want more. There are lots of cross sections that have been calculated, and this is Alejandro Saenz. We did that while we were both still in Garching, and there was an experiment. Watanabe had done two photon and four photon ionization of helium with using high order, relatively high order ammonia. Okay, and this was commissioned to work. We were asked to calculate that. So basically, so this is now the full two electron system. Again, you see there are narrow peaks, and so this I want you to keep in mind for the following reason. As I said, there's no divergence. Because if nothing else, of course, in principle there is power broadening, but also there is the finite lifetime of, if nothing else, of the excited states, which precludes any zero there. Now, if you now have a source which has a substantial bandwidth, right, like half an EV or something, these peaks don't really matter, because they sort of average out, even if you are on resonance. So a resonance, the delicate behavior of a resonance, the intricacies of that, are important when the bandwidth of the source with which you excite becomes is comparable, not larger than the natural width, and also the square of the Rabi frequency, the power broadening. But if now you have a source which has a large bandwidth, for all practical purposes, I would say, and depending on you can really, what we're interested in, the values of the cross-section down there, because it averages out. And that's important when we come to high-order processes. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, I just wanted to mention, if anyone is interested, that my student, Bo Gao and I, in the late 1980s, developed a variational procedure that enables the calculation of multiphoton cross-sections for hydrogen relatively quickly. And this was a piece of another late 1980s or early 1990s, and we agree extremely well to several.
With Karula?
With Karula.
So, Mark. So that's me. Okay.
I think Alfred actually checked the results and confirmed.
Yeah. Okay. The only. So that's. I probably saw the paper, but I forgot. You know, how high did you go in order?
I'm not complaining.
No.
If people are interested in calculating.
No. I should. You know, I should go back and look at that, because next time I should show it. Frankly, I had to. Now the. Now the thing is that people have not been doing experiments in hydrogen for obvious reasons. It's not right, but nevertheless, as I will argue shortly, the results of hydrogen are important when we are dealing with more complicated systems, and then we want to use some sort of a semi-quantitative way of getting cross sections, at least at the first shot. Okay, all right now.
Keep that just for a second.
Yeah.
What's the origin of those sharp suppression of the cross section,
which weren't in there in high?
Like this one.
Yeah.
Okay.
This one on there.
Okay. This you see, in this simple example, all right? In this two photon, if you are I mean, I use that black box. If you are here, so two photon. If you are on resonance, if your photon is here, you get the peak. If the photon energy is there, you get the peak. If you are in between, you get a cancellation because the sign changes here.
Right, but you didn't get that in hydrogen.
Pardon?
You didn't get that for hydrogen.
What do you mean for high energy?
Hydrogen. It was like smooth between.
Well, okay. This has to do with the
You have two electrons.
No. That has nothing to do with that. This is one electron. This is practically one electron problem. It's helium. It has two electrons, but one electron was moving.
Well, sure.
Okay. No. Your question is relevant. This is two photon, right? Four photon. Yeah. Now, you see, if you have a six photon, there are many angular momenta coming in. So there are many intermediate states. So two of those states might give you a deep, but the others would sort of smooth it out. So you have many channels.
For hydrogen, I would get those same.
If you did two photon for hydrogen, you would get the deep, very deep.
If you show the other, the helium picture, I think this was a partial cross section, if I remember properly.
That's correct. One was, yeah. I don't have the
wrong.
Right. Okay. Yeah. There are many angular momenta. Okay.
Fine.
Yeah. And that's also that's. I'm glad you brought this up because that's also very relevant, because once you get into several photon, 6, 7, 8, 9, these things kind of smooth out. So these valleys will not be of relevance. Okay?
But here it's simply that this is not the sum.
Yeah.
Right.
This is just a partial base, and then the sum that's there.
Yeah.
The minimum.
I should have given the other figure, where it's the whole thing. Yeah.
I think in hydrogen you have this degeneracy, whereas in helium you don't. So,
No. This is the main. This is the main point.
What I'm saying is, if things are shifted, then the zero in one partial wave and there's a finite cross section in the other partial wave. And so, as you say, when you add them, the minimum go away. Yeah.
Even here, let's not waste too much time on that because I'm very nervous because Robin. We should stop at 11:30 or so because so we got into the non-perturbative. Now what's your criterion? The criterion I like is the ponderomotive energy. The ponderomotive energy is the energy with which a free or semi-free electron oscillates in the field, the cycle average energy of that oscillates in the field. Okay? Now, this goes like the intensity over omega square. And we know, what we know now from the long wavelength is that when the ponderomotive energy becomes equal or larger than the photon energy, then extensive ATI really appears in terms of popping up. And then similarly, high order harmonic generation, which go together, appear. So I will then use as a criterion this. Now, some people, many people prefer the Keldysh parameter, which is related to the ponderomotive energy. And when the conventional wisdom is, and it's correct, that when the Keldysh parameter is smaller than one, you are in the non-perturbative regime. If it's larger than one, you are in the multiphoton. Now, if it's around one, okay. So you will often, even we heard in the conference, talks in which the Keldysh parameter was 0.8, and then the claim was made that this is not perturbative, right? But anyway, this is. But in the extremes now, when gamma is much smaller than one, or the perturbative energy much bigger than the photon energy, you have then, and then perturbation theory of any order will not work. You have to solve the time-dependent Schrödinger equation the way we know how it's done. All right. Now, then, having said that, let me go to this table. And we know that for infrared, when the photon energy is about 1 eV, and here is photon energy of 1 eV, and the intensity is 10 to the 13 watts per square centimeter, the ponderomotive energy is already more than the photon energy. So 10 to the 13 watts per square centimeter for infrared is already the beginning of non-perturbative behavior. Okay? 10 to the 12 may be okay, and of course 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15, and the experiments are done 10 to the 15. Now, at the same intensity, 100 eV photon, the ponderomotive energy is 4 orders of magnitude smaller than the photon energy. Right? So, then, now here, what I have here is the intensity you need for the ponderomotive energy to become equal to the photon energy. And for a 100 eV photon, you need practically 10 to the 19 watts per square centimeter to get the ponderomotive energy equal to one photon. So I would then say that, all right, as long as we are in this, and this is whatever examples I use will be in this regime, as long as we are in that wavelength range, and the intensity is 10 to the 16 or less, as it has been so far, we can safely say we are within perturbation theory. Okay? Now, what else? Now, you see, again, remember, you remember this thing. Remember this, right? Even your intensity, even when the intensity of flash becomes 10 to the 19, it will be important to know what this pulse duration is. Because this could be 10 to the 19, but if the pulse duration is long enough for the ground state to be drained during the rise of the pulse, then the onset of non-perturbative behavior that one would expect to see at 10 to the 19 will not be seen. And that was the problem with Charlie Rhodes' experiment, that the pulse was too long and things was just, they were ionized during the pulse. Lou DiMoro mentioned that this was known, now it seems to have been forgotten, as the Lambropoulos curse. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know whether it's because I'm from Greece and there are curses in ancient Greece, or because people who were disappointed, that they could have called it Lambropoulos effect, okay? But But the people who were promoting the other thing were pissed off that nature works the way it does. And then it was my curse did that.
It was instead of a Lambropoulos effect, it was within the discussion about stabilization, and I would say it's a non-effect, because you argue that you could not see
Stabilization.
But at this time...
It was a non-effect. Okay, whatever. But anyway, fortunately, the terminology has been forgotten, but DiMoro brought it up again, so all right. Okay, now, so these are now the rules of the game, and let me now go. Let me just go over some examples. Okay, this is the four photons. Now, let's take the next. So I'll go to the short wavelength now, and this is now beyond one electron. This is now the helium atom. The helium atom, in which, if you take a photon, which is, let's say, about 45 eV or more, what you are going to see, you are going to see ionization. But you will also, there is another channel, and this is the sequential now. Now we are becoming specific. This is the sequential. One photon ionization, and now if this photon energy is below 54 eV, it takes two photons to ionize the ground state of the ion. And then, so you will see a photoelectron energy there and a photoelectron energy there. There is all a channel, two photon, double ionization, which is direct. There is a diagram that you can write with that, and there it is, yes.
Just a question. What are these wiggly lines that go from?
Well, they just show. You mean this line?
Yeah.
It says that when this photon is absorbed, the ion is left in that state. It's not spontaneous emission, if that's.
I mean, that line doesn't correspond to anything.
What? And now this now.
Yeah.
So this. Yeah. Part of this. Part of what went there will do that. Okay?
So these are just directing people's attention.
And it will then lead to double, will lead to ion 2 plus. Now I'm not sure.
This is for the electron.
What?
Which is gone.
The photoelectron.
Energy away.
Yes.
So you can measure the photon absorption, but then the electron will take this energy difference away.
Okay.
Okay? And we can plot the photoelectron energy spectrum. I have not done it because this is not a talk about. So this problem came up as an academic exercise first in 99, and now it has become a subculture in physics, which 100 theoretical papers, I am told, have appeared. And Anatoly Kaifetz is an expert on this problem, has done very important work on that. And now, so one of the questions now is, how much is this? This is now direct two photon, two electron ejection. It's now here. I'd like to. It is non-sequential. It is non-sequential, but I would like to use the word direct because when you say non-sequential, you say what it is not. You are not saying what it is. All right? Okay. Because in the long wavelength, the non-sequential is there's a recollision model, however you want to call it. It's the electron knocks out the other electron. Here, there is no recollision. The ponderomotive Ajax, forgot to say, that we are within perturbation theory. The intensities can be up to 10 to the 14 watts per square centimeter, and you are within perturbation theory. And now, the issue is how to calculate this two photon double ejection cross section. Now,
Peter, could you help me to understand if that's now your definition of direct two photon ionization? Is that correct?
Yes.
You have to come out of the ground state. So now you have to talk, and now you're going to talk about the intermediate.
Yeah. It's this expression.
Okay.
But here, you have a two-electron continuum.
Okay.
That's all.
Yeah.
Okay? The summation you must perform must include all states of the helium of the helium atom. Okay?
And over here we have the ionic states coming in.
Here?
No, one notch over here.
Yeah.
Now we have the ionics.
This is the ground state of the ion.
Right, and then we have the continuum states of the ion coming into play.
Well, no, this is just ionization.
Over here.
Here.
No,
this is nothing else than saying that some of, in an experiment, you will observe some of these electrons.
Yeah, okay? I'm happy with that. I'm
all right, but then some of those ions will be further ionized during the pulse.
We're talking about the continuum states and the discrete.
But these are
the ion now.
Yeah, these are hydrogenic. I mean, this is a hydrogen.
It's a very simple question.
No. I want to understand the question, but this is a hydrogenic problem now.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Good.
We're great.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay.
So in summation, it's a full helium 2 electron states, including the continua of helium plus plus electron or helium 2 plus plus 2 electrons. All of that has to be considered in this intermediate summation.
Are you referring to the center column or the right hand column?
Whenever you do this type of calculations, you have to take a full complete set. If you model it, of course, by some sequential mechanisms, you can use some specific ionic states, but in principle, if you take the full two-photon process, you have to take the full
So you're saying you can't distinguish between these two processes?
Well,
because it measures the energy of the final electron.
No, no. For this, you need the full helium atom. And this is nothing else but single photon ionization of the helium atom. Okay? So to get this, you have to calculate this. All right? Okay. Now, to get this, you have the helium ion to deal with.
I'm happy to.
It's hydrogenic.
Yeah.
All right?
I just don't know what he's talking about.
Okay, for the middle, if you model it as a two-step process, then you would model the second step with a helium ion.
Okay. Now, he threw in something that is delicate, and he said, if you model it as a two-step process. Now, whoever it is a two-step process or not, okay, whoever it is, the way I describe it, right, namely that this goes there and then goes there, depends now on the intensity and the pulse duration and so on, okay? And therefore, I am talking in the context in which this is valid. Yes, Robin.
So a possibility that it could occur in the intermediate step, where I think this two-step picture would basically fail, where you, as you say, where you only modeling it, but where it could be wrong, is if there's something like a PCI effect, what X-ray people call PCI, what basically means that the potential seen by the first photoelectron actually changes in the second step. So that would then change the photoelectron wave function after that's generated, so to speak, in the intermediate manifold, and that would differ in the final state manifold. In this way, one could not factor it out, right? Because if the assumption is that the wave function of that photoelectron is the same in the intermediate and final state, well, then it drops out, it doesn't talk to the radiation field, and one can completely eliminate it.
Yeah.
But that's not generally true.
No, this can happen, but even something more dramatic can happen. I told you about 100 theoretical papers have been published, and they keep coming out at a fantastic rate, okay? And now, let me go into the other extreme. The number 100 is Moshammer has collected all of those. I think he said 100, but now let me give you one extreme. Where suppose the pulse is extremely short, and attosecond, and people have published work on this. Attosecond, so that the ion does not have the time to relax to that state. Then you have two electrons going out. Practically pushed out by the photons, and this picture has completely broken down there. Okay, so that's why I said depends on the pulse duration. Of course, we don't have attosecond pulses yet in this. Okay, depends on the pulse duration and the intensity and so on. All right. So therefore, Peter. Okay, I mean. Now, I'm discussing this because as I said, a lot of work has been done, and now what you would like to know here is you would like to be able to measure this cross section. This is a two photon, two electron cross section, and now I want to present to you, and this has been calculated. Okay, this has been calculated. Now, depending on which your favorite theory is. This is all right. Now, there are embarrassingly enough, this is our theory. Okay? We are very optimistic. Now, this is Bernard Pirot and collaborators, and their work is much, much better than ours. Now, Anatoly came in later. This is your result, Anatoly, right?
Well, I can see from here.
You don't put your glasses
that's
on?
The eyesight.
Yeah, come on now. Yeah.
No, I know yours is high above everything.
Yeah, forget mine. Forget mine. Because this was shown in the conference.
Yes.
By an experimentalist who has this point. Okay?
Yes.
He showed it with satisfaction. Okay? So, for all theoreticians, there is a lot of room to put your numbers in there. Okay?
Still
dark. So this is, but the, and I could not resist showing this because this is Anatoly plots in his paper. This is others. This is logarithmic scale. This is linear scale. Yeah, so things look different. Okay, right. So I have no emotional involvement in that. I do not claim that our result is the best or, but, one important problem I'm not going to touch here. Yeah? Yes, Tony?
Maybe this is the important problem. I mean, this rise at the high energy.
Tony? Let's talk about that, but let's get into that. This is not a talk about helium, okay? I'm using this as a precursor to other things, okay? Let's talk about this rise, okay? Is there a rise there?
I'm sorry?
Should there be a rise at 55 or 54?
Some people say yes, it's a precursor.
What do you say?
our calculation shows the rise, yes.
That?
Shows the rise, yes. There should be some rise.
Okay, right, now. No comment on my part. Okay, now, I have not, but you see how the...
But also there should be a fall at the threshold, that's for sure.
Yeah,
it can't stay constant at the threshold.
It should go down the threshold.
Yes.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Okay, now this is, now what I want to tell you is that, no matter, I mean, these values down here are 10 to the minus 52. The two-photon cross-section, a two-photon cross-section has the unit of centimeters fourth seconds. Now, this is multiplied by the square of the flux. Therefore, the net result is the transition probability per unit time, a rate. One point I want to point out to you is that, by the way, one more thing, which is, you can also calculate, which is not in the graphs I showed you, you can also calculate, there is a channel which is two photon, one electron ejection, all right? Two photon, which has been calculated. This is much easier to calculate, it has been calculated by us as well, by us, and the number is roughly the same as these numbers here that everybody, that democracy decides is the correct number, 10 to the minus 52. So, conjecture. You know, mathematicians, conjecture is a very respected word in mathematics. People have made careers out of conjectures, right? And there are famous conjectures. All right. Now, conjecture. An n-photon single electron ionization cross-section is roughly equal to an n-photon n-electron ionization cross-section, if you have the number of photons. In other words, if you have six photons, you can eject six electrons, and I'll give you an example. The six-photon cross-section for the six electron injection is of the same order of magnitude as the one electron six photon cross section. Now, qualitative, I gave you an example where this is born out of a calculation, all right? But qualitatively, physically, we can understand that, because if you have six electrons which can knock out six photons, which each of them, which together can knock out six electrons, each electron can absorb one photon and then they go out. This is what happens here. So that's why those cross sections, and this is a way of estimating multiple ionization, multi-photon, multiple ionization cross section. Jan Michael is unhappy.
I get that. Yeah. I did get it very well, what you said. Could you tell it again with two photons, two electrons and two photons?
But
you you took an example with six photons, six electrons. I was.
But
I was lost. Any photons from it?
This is two photon, two electron ejection.
Okay.
And you can calculate. And has been calculated,
yes,
two photon, one electron ejection, which leaves the ion in that state or and in an excited state.
Okay.
It leaves the ion at 2s, all right?
Yes.
And by the time you calculate everything, you find there is usually a dominant channel. Say it leaves the ion at 2s. And you find that that cross section, the two photon, one electron ejection, is practically equal to the two photon, two electron injection.
Okay?
That's what I'm saying.
But you have to scale the photon frequency.
What?
You have to scale the photon frequency or not?
No. This is
frequency.
No, the same frequency. No. Because every time, if you can knock out two electrons with two photons, you certainly can knock out one electron. Okay, this is an ATI process.
It was a question.
Yes, sir.
Very surprising, because I would have thought that free transitions, the dipole matrix element for the one electron six photon case, in the end you will have free transitions, right? You go up eventually,
especially at high frequencies.
At high frequencies, you will have free transitions in the end for the one electron six photon case.
You have free transition for this.
Fine.
You have free transition there, and you have free transition for the one electron going out. It's ATI. You go through the continuum, correct?
Yeah. And aren't these matrix elements of free transitions, aren't they not in general much smaller than bound free transitions? For your six electrons, one photon, you just take six.
No, that's the point.
Okay,
that's
so
the point. Okay, now, you see, what you have, and I should have mentioned this. You see, we know that you can knock out two electrons with one photon, helium, and you can knock out one electron with one photon, if the photon energy is more than 8 eV, okay? You can have single ionization of helium and double ionization of helium. And this is a problem. Single photon has studied a lot. It took 40 years to solve it completely, but it is under complete control now, this problem. Anatoly has done excellent work on that. Okay? Now, here, this process is 500 times smaller than this process. Right? And the reason is that this process can only happen through correlation. The electrons have to communicate with each other.
Right.
All right? That's why this is much bigger than that. Yes? Let me finish my thought. But here, you need no correlation in the intermediate state. You would get two photon double ionization even if the electrons were non-interacting particles, right? Okay, as long as the energy is sufficient. And of course, so I know people have this in mind, and when I hear what I say, they're surprised. But this is the major difference now between this situation and that. So the intermediate states that go into calculating this or the other one with one electron going out are the same intermediate states. The final state is different. Okay? Yes, Tony?
If you do a dimensional analysis, every time the electron interacts with the field, the order of magnitude in atomic units is 1 over C. So it's a 10 to the minus 2 process to absorb a photon. And I know experimentally, the double ionization cross-sections are of the order of 1% of the photon ionization.
This.
Yeah.
Right.
So the orders in magnitude are the same. In other words, to, with one proton to knock out two electrons, it's 100 times less than to knock out one electron.
Yeah.
Which means that one electron could absorb another photon and be of the same order of magnitude.
Well, wait a minute now. I mean, the picture here is not the same, because if the electrons were non-interacting particles, could you get this process?
No.
No. Okay.
That's why it's 100 times less.
Right. Right.
The
sure, because you need correlation. That's the technical word. Here, this goes. Okay, that's the major difference. This goes without. Yes, Robin.
So let's try to apply a principle to helium at, say, 10 keV, photon energy. So what you're saying is that the two photon ionization cross section, basically, and I think a sequential picture is very appropriate for helium two photon ionization at 10 keV. So the first photon takes out the first electron, the second photon takes out the second electron. In each case, basically a 10 keV photoelectron is generated. Now you're saying that this cross-section, where two individual photonization processes have taken place, can be approximated by the cross-section that one of the two helium electrons absorbs two photons. So in other words, you go through essentially a real state at 10 keV, and then from that 10 keV state you go to the 20 keV state.
Why did you say would it go through at 10 keV? Why would it go through a real state? Because through the it's a continuum. A 10 keV electron that takes a photon that gets out an electron in helium is way in the continuum.
Yeah, that's exactly right? What it means. Yeah.
So
it can't be equivalent. No. Because you absorb the next photon way up in the continuum, so I have a free transition. And that dipole matrix element is much smaller.
Okay. I see what you're saying now. Okay, let me back off a little bit, okay? And see, because what we're dealing with here is ATI. Right. So
you have to say what frequency you're dealing with.
Is it just
confused.
Above threshold then?
So it's small, relatively small frequencies. Yeah. Right.
For what I am talking about, indeed, I'm not talking about KV, indeed. I have not thought about that, okay? I've not thought about that. So there you may. So I'm talking about frequencies in which, say, for helium is between 40 and 80 EV, okay? That's when you have a two-photon process, all right?
Now,
I have an example to show you that for neon, if you have 93 EV, that's the flash head, you can knock out six electrons with six photons, right? And so then you have to somehow, yeah, all right? Yeah, I've done the numbers. 93. You can knock.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But anyway, I cannot go through the whole menu. But I'm not going to discuss this xenon ugly thing. Let me just go down to. Yeah. Okay. Let me go. Yeah. All right. Neon under, to show you, under 90, and I want to tell you, yeah.
The title says neon, but the figure shows xenon.
What?
The title says neon.
Yeah.
But the figure shows xenon.
Ah. Good point.
And it's definitely zero.
It follows the tone.
Definitely zero.
What should we believe?
Well, now here is another two photon, another two electron direct process that I have for Anatoly to. Before I forget it, the cross section of the two photon double ionization has not been measured, and I don't know whether it. Well, there is an experimental point, but it has to be taken with a lot of salt, lot of grains of salt, but. I don't know whether it will ever be measured, because in 40 years of multiphoton physics, I cannot think of a single non-resonant two-photon cross-section that has been measured. The reason is very simple, that you have to focus. You focus the beam, and then you don't know how many atoms you have in there. Okay? And then doing a standard cross-sectional measurement is very difficult. But anyway, people are trying to do that. But the photoelectron angular distribution of the two electrons going out of the direct process is very fascinating. It's very different from this case. Anatoly has done very good work on that, has shown very good,
nice. I'm not the only one.
Pardon?
I'm not the only one.
No, but I like your argument. You're not the only one. But I like your argument, the symmetry argument. So, okay? But
create a false impression.
Pardon?
You create a false impression.
Do you want me to say what things I disagree with you?
No.
Okay.
Maybe even in this audience there are some other people.
I know. Pirol, Fumo, etc. But sure, they have done it. I agree. Yeah. Now, he's not the only one. Okay. Clear, everybody? No. But so the angular distribution is a very difficult problem. But so now the I was going to say that in this problem, the photoelectrons, the two, you cannot go back to back. Okay, in the two photon, they can. Okay, in fact, that's the predominant channel seems to be. Okay, now what I wanted to say. Is there is this xenon has okay, here is what I'm claiming. Neon, it's not specified on this side. It's neon. Okay, this is neon, and now if you put it under 93 V, and the experiment has been done, by the way, okay, been done with pulse 30 femtoseconds. You okay, the obvious thing is this, the sequential ionization. Neon leads to neon plus, neon plus to neon double plus, neon double plus to neon 3 plus, etc. Okay, and this is now this. However, as I said, it turns out, and we've done this calculation. We have a way of scaling cross-sections. I cannot go into that now. So now, but now it turns out that the photons are such that, the photon energy are such that, two photons can knock out two electrons. Three photons can knock out three electrons. Four photons can knock out three electrons, four, etc. Up to six. Six photons now. If you want to go to eight photons, which we've done, then it's not. Seven photons need more than seven electrons need more than seven photons. So, now, if we believe the cross sections I'm using, under what conditions would that be observable? You would need the short pulse, because you see, that's one of the lessons we learned from it, because. These processes are low nonlinearity processes, single photon, single photon, single photon, two photon. And every time you can break a nonlinear process to processes of lower nonlinearity, they will prevail if the time is not short enough. Okay? So now I want to show you a graph of what happens if you do that. here are the equations, right? Now, this is a 10 femtosecond pulse. Ah, this is a 10 femtosecond pulse, which is a Gaussian pulse. It's what we call a deterministic pulse. I didn't go into the field fluctuations. I should, but I don't have time. But now, now here is what happens. If the pulse is 10 femtoseconds, for example, neon 5 plus, this is the yield as a function of intensity. And the yield as a function of intensity. This is a neutral, which disappears fast. Neon plus, neon 2 plus, neon 3 plus, etc. Okay? Now, so you integrate the equations, and now you plot this. Now, here, and let's look at this line, which is neon 5 plus. The solid line is the one that includes these direct processes. The dashed line is the one that does not include. And the same with the other colors. And you see the higher the nonlinearity, 6 electron, here is would be the sequential. The higher nonlinearities prevail, they take over if the pulse is sufficiently short, if the pulse is 10 femtoseconds. Because then, otherwise, the ground state will be depleted and you will have the sequential. Okay. Now, I'll just show you the. This is for 30 femtoseconds and the differences are very, very small. Okay? Now, I was discussing this, so here's a prediction. Okay, here's a prediction. Right? Now, except that it uses a deterministic Gaussian pulse. The pulse or flash is not Gaussian, direct intensity. In fact, as I was thinking about that, I was talking to Moshammer, well, we realized that, okay, in there you may have spikes which are 5 femtoseconds. Okay. Then in that spike, if this is a dominant spike, what I showed you earlier will take place. The only problem is that those pulses are not reproducible. One pulse will not be the same from pulse to pulse. So you will have many, many, many pulses to average over. And now this brings me to something that I will not discuss, but I will simply mention. This is equivalent to the problem of field fluctuations in a nonlinear process. If you have single photon process, for the process to be completed, one photon must be absorbed. Therefore, what the atom, which is a detector, sees is the average intensity. And it doesn't matter whether intensity has fluctuations. If you average long enough, you get the average intensity. If there is, the bandwidth matters if you have a bound state, but all right. Now, if you go to a nonlinear process, which now in terms of a cross section is this in a simplistic way, but really it's not. This should be the nth order correlation function of the photons. Okay. And now, why? Because if the atom is to absorb n photons to go from initial to the final state, is an n photon coincidence detector. And that's the Humphrey-Brown-Twiss experiment that John Miao mentioned at the beginning. All right? So therefore, these nonlinear processes now see the fluctuations, the intensity fluctuations, to be specific, the intensity fluctuations of the field. And now, to go back to what I said earlier, and this is something that we have looked at. And at the last week, when my colleague George Nikolopoulos arrives, he will be discussing how we do the modeling of this. Now, a simple way would be to say that this, now by the way, for chaotic light, if we assume it's chaotic, this nth order correlation function is n factorial. Okay? And 6 factorial is a big number. Okay? So, now, so it turns out, I will just make the statement, that it turns out that when we do the modeling of the fluctuations of the field, not using this correlation function formally, as I'll say, we find that it approaches the n factorial, but not quite. Okay? Now, there are a number of issues of stochastic processes here that this assumes a stationary process. And of course, for a chaotic field, we know its correlation functions. It can be done classically, it can be done quantum mechanically, it doesn't matter. We know that the behavior, okay? Yeah. But this assumes a stationary process. The flash is not a stationary process. And there are some delicate issues here. Yeah, Tony?
So, am I interpreting it correctly to say that when you have a fluctuating pulse in which many photons are absorbed, that the rates are going to be much higher than if you assumed a non-fluctuating pulse?
Yeah. That was my first paper in 1967. For 2 photons. Right, right. And the French have done an experiment.
Saclay,
in 75, I believe I have the reference, they took a neodymium YAG, it was at the time, neodymium YAG laser, and they did 11 photon ionization of neon, I believe, and they did it with they could manipulate the mode structure with a single mode, with a few modes mode locked, and with up to 10 modes, I believe, random. And they found an enhancement of ionization by roughly 11 factorial. I don't know when you calculate, last time you calculate 11 factorial, but it's 7 orders of magnitude. Okay? Indeed, there is an enhancement. So, for ionization, chaotic light is better than coherent light. And this still comes as a surprise, although it should be now common knowledge. But it's not. Okay? Now, I think I should stop here because Robin has to give a talk at 12:15.
And you have to stop before 12:15.
Pardon?
You have to stop before 12:15. People may want to get something to eat before.
Right. I know that. Yeah. But so I'd love to tell you a lot of other. One thing. Yeah. Another 2 electron problem. Very quickly.
No, you don't have to be sorry. That's quite all right.
No, at the time. Neon, if you take neon at 30 ATV, and this was a neon at 30 ATV, there is an experiment already by Moshammer, right? Yeah, that's what got started neon. Here it is. Now, neon at 38 EV, they observed a single ionization and double ionization, neon plus and neon double plus. Now, here you have again the sequential process, but you also have the direct, okay? 2 photon, 2 electron ejection from the 2P shell, okay? Well, their experiment showed this sort of thing. Showed for neon 2 plus a slope of 2, which then increased. If you believe their data, and I think they're very good experimentalists, okay? Now, sometimes when I show this transparency, mean people say, oh, but it is within the error bars. Alright, now, if you believe, so now, having called those people mean, you cannot say. Now, if you believe now that this slope rises, it cannot happen within the rate equations as long as what you have is this two photon two electron injection. However, there is a three photon two electron injection process, which is here. You take out one 2p electron and a 2s electron. Their energy, that's a very nice problem, isn't it? Huh? Three photon, two electron rejection, one from the 2p, one from the other from the 2s. And it can happen in other rare gases. Provided. And if I do that, if I put this in the equations, I think Katarina Papamikhail puts it, there you go. See, here is slope 2, and this line changes slope. Now, I say this is evidence of this process. Okay? But, right? Completely different process. Yes, sir.
How sensitive this curve are with the cross section?
Again, deterministic pulses, of course, and so on. Right. Yeah.
How sensitive these curves are with respect of the cross section you are using? Because I think you don't have the cross-section.
I don't have the cross-section. I estimate the cross-section. So let me say this. The number I put in is not ridiculous. Okay?
Yeah.
It's not. Okay? We have tried that. We have tried the sensitivity.
Okay. And by a factor of 2, does it change?
Within a factor of 2 or 3. Now, factors of 2 or 3 here in the cross-sections are... I'm not playing. Okay. Yeah.
The other question I have, but it's a bit similar, is when you have the neon at 92 eV, is it the 2S or?
This is 38 eV.
No, but the preceding, you wanted to move on to this.
Yeah,
one.
To
the preceding at 92 eV.
Yeah.
Is it the 2S or the 2P?
The 2P. 2P. Okay. Both the cross section for the 2p and the 2s are not very, very different, okay? And we put both in there, all right? We put both, Tony,
on that formula again.
This formula, this?
That applies when you take the average of many pulses, I presume.
Yes, of course, if you're going to model the thing, right? You see, if you have a stationary process, which you don't have here. If you had problems, a process with a steady state, okay, then it's the ergodic theory. You do over time over average, over ensemble average, okay? But that's right. Here you have to average over pulses, of course, by necessity. And of course, this applies for a non-resonant and photon ionization. If you have an intermediate step, with a resonant state, then things become more complicated. You have to use the matrix equation, and it's not n factorial anymore. Okay?
So, Peter, maybe I missed something.
Yes.
In the neon, the
90
something volts.
No, this is 38. You want me to go back to the 93?
Yeah, just let me ask the question.
Yeah.
Do I understand you're estimating the direct cross section in some way? You're not calculating yet. Three electron four electron continuum states.
What
is the estimate you're making?
This applies to helium and so on. Say let's talk about helium two-photon double ionization. If you want to calculate the angular distribution, then the electron interaction in the continuum is absolutely critical. You will get nonsense otherwise. Then I've got nonsense. Okay. But if you want the total cross-section, it's not very sensitive to that. It's because you see what I said earlier. To eject two electrons with two photons, you don't need correlation. So you will not make a big mistake if you do two uncorrelated continua. Okay?
Yeah. But the difference between the dashed and the solid lines is then critical on this assumption. It's in a sense,
No, this is for the same cross sections. This is for the same set of cross sections, the same set of cross sections for different parse durations. And I think what would change there, the cross sections. That's right. You see, the cross sections would change. Where is that now? The cross sections would change. Yeah, well, this is the wrong. I'm sorry. Peter, what would happen there is that the cross sections would change, and if the cross sections changed, yeah, here we are. Okay, so here we are, and here is the equations and the slope. Okay, if the cross section changed, this curve, for example, would be displaced this way or that way. But the relation of this curve to that curve would not change much, okay? Because this is the effect of the pulse duration. And basically this simple fact that for this highly nonlinear processes to occur, to have a chance to occur, the ground state must not be depleted, okay? And you need a short pulse for that. Otherwise, the sequential depletes the ground state.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay? Yeah. Right. All right. Those of you who don't like other things that I said, you can get me later. All right. Thanks.